situation where economically it couldn't maintain its far-flung empire, that other powers were growing in strength compared with it, that created problems. 1932, the Imperial Defence Council said, in the Far East, Japan is now stronger than Britain. Calamity could occur at any time. 35, the same is said about Italy and Africa. Italy is in a position to expand into it. Same applies later on as regards Germany. And they said, well, the answer here is to try and drive Germany to the east. Hit its head against the Soviet Union. And if both are weakened, or both are destroyed as a result of this, it's extremely good from a British standpoint. But also, you have the question arising of the United States. The United States was still, at that time, an enemy of Britain. Indeed, the interesting thing is, March the 17th, 1939, German troops went into Prague. March the 17th, 1939, Britain signed an agreement with German industry. The CBI and the Reich industries agreed to pool their resources, and largely it was a pooling of resources against the United States, because the United States was lessening British interests in Latin America, and only if you came together with the Germans was there any possibility of dealing with this problem. So you see that this looked at purely and simply in terms of realpolitik, the question of power and influence. And it's one of the things, I've just written a small book here, which I make, and I think has not really been made by anybody else, but I think it's an important point. And in a sense, it really follows on from what Neville Chamberlain said. You know, Neville Chamberlain said, Czechoslovakia is a faraway country about which we know, most people know nothing. And this was true. The vast majority of people knew nothing about Czechoslovakia. It's perfectly true about the working class. So it wasn't they who took the vital decision on how to go, whether Britain should go to war over Czechoslovakia. It was not they who took the decision on whether to go to war over Poland. There were a small group of people, businessmen, financiers, with the ear to the government, who really took this essential decision. Shall we go to war over this? If we do go to war over this, we have to make concessions elsewhere, because we can't fight Germany and at the same time fight in the Far East and at the same time fight the Americans in Latin America. So this was the problem which Britain confronted. Now, so far as the Labour Party was concerned, the Labour Party's foreign policy was, if anything, at times more reactionary than that of the Conservatives. Ellen Wilkinson, in the book which I referred to, Why War, said wars are caused by imperialism, and the Labour Party entirely accepts imperialism. And she went on to quote the Labour colonial secretary, who said, Britain under a Labour government must have the bombing aircraft. We must have the bombing aircraft so we can bomb the Iraqis. And she said, well, you know, if this is the case, and he also said how humane it was to use the aircraft. And the suggestion was that really it shouldn't come out of the military budget at all. It should be charged to the Red Cross account, you see. And then after this, you have Lord Londonderry getting up. This is when MacDonald has gone over from Labour and formed a national government. And Lord Londonderry gets up at the World Disarmament Conference, as every politician who was there did. We're in favour of peace, and we're in favour of disarmament, but start with those armaments which our country has the fewest of, and get on to the last of all, to those which we have the most of. And so Lord Londonderry said, Britain must keep the bombing aircraft to deal with a dissident tribesman on the northwest Indian frontier. If you want to translate that into present day terms, the grandfathers of the Afghan freedom fighters. And of course, the World Disarmament Conference didn't get anywhere in 1933, and the bombing aircraft was kept. And thanks to that, or thanks not to that, in 1940-41 you had the Blitz of this country. You had even, and this is quite scandalous, the Labour Party putting down a motion in the House of Commons in 1938, not about the fact that the people who are on an unemployment benefit couldn't provide themselves and their families with coal over winter. Not things like that, but why aren't you spending, says Dr. Dalton, more money on bombers? That's what the government should be doing. That is a position which was adopted. So right in 1939, when war comes, actually, Clem Attlee, he was the leader of the party, was having a prostate operation, and his deputy, Arthur Greenwood, spoke for the Labour Party. And Arthur Greenwood got up and made a speech which suggested that Britain should stand firm, support Marshal Pilsudski, who was the dictator of Poland, irrespective of what anybody else did. And as he was speaking, the right wing of the Conservatives, people like Leo Amery, said, speak for England, Arthur! That was the position which was adopted. Afterwards, Arthur Greenwood went up to the Prime Minister's office and said, you couldn't see what your supporters were thinking. They were with me. They weren't with you, in the more dovish line which he was adopting. So right, that was the position leading up to the war. Once the war starts, there's a lot of malarkey talked about this. It was not 100% standing together, hey lads, hey, what a fine thing it is, and that waving Union Jacks and all the rest of it. There was quite a considerable anti-war movement. For example, 1940, National Union of Students Conference came out again the war. The by-elections, candidates standing on anti-war platforms often got more votes, more greater proportion of the votes, than had been got in the 1935 general election. And you start getting protests shown in a variety of ways. Not initially in terms of strikes, although it comes in 1942 and becomes even greater. One of the biggest strike waves this country has had came in 1944. Because people come to realise that society is a class-divided society. That you might have to sit under, or rather lie under, this table when the bombs come down, hopefully keeping being safe. But if you happen to be a member of the cabinet, you can go to the Carlton Club. And beneath the Carlton Club, and beneath the Ritz, and so on and so forth, there are massive shelters which members of the cabinet and big businessmen actually stayed in along with their wives, having whiskey walked to them right throughout the night, or what have you. But one set of conditions for you, were another set of conditions for the rest, for the few. And this feeling of divisions in society was one which became more and more obvious and clear. I mean, many things sort of are important which really have not have been forgotten. For example, the Churchill tank was a very poor tank. It was decided to produce it on one day. People who designed it did it on one day. None of them had ever been in a tank. But that isn't the important thing about the Churchill tank. Churchill tank didn't have the lightest metal, brilliant. The German tanks did. So why didn't the British tank? For a very simple reason. The Germans had the patent rights. And you can't break patent rights, can you? Of course you can't. So the German tanks went quicker. They could withstand shells much more easily and so on. And the same sort of thing applied with the Messerschmitt 109 component of the Spitfire. And their bulletproof glass, which the Messerschmitt had. And then of course there were other things. You can sacrifice on the beaches and so on and so forth. But you don't sacrifice if you're a shareholder in Skoda, the Czechoslovakian arms manufacturer. Because after it is taken over by Germany and produces for the Nazi war effort, the money for Skoda, your shares, will go through an international bank in Zurich so that you will get the profit. Not merely that, of course, a lot of the Panzer divisions. The Panzer divisions were depended on armoured cars. Who produced a lot of the German armoured cars? It was Opel. What is Opel? It's the German branch of General Motors. So who gets the money from the profits from General Motors? Clearly the shareholders get the profits. And it was things like this which were becoming more and more, people were becoming more and more acquainted with as the war went on. Now what about war itself? I want to suggest that a war is like a three-legged stool. If you were to take one of the legs away, cut it off, the whole thing collapses. You don't have to cut all three legs apart. One leg will do. Now what are the three legs? First of all, there are those who decide on war. We've agreed that we don't decide on war as working people. It is decided. Who helped to take a decision here that we go to war, Britain would go to war over Kuwait? Did anybody on this side of the room take part in the decision over the Falklands? Of course you didn't. No, these decisions are taken by the ruling class. The second is the army, or rather the military. That is the second leg. If the military decide, no, we're voting with our feet, we're not fighting any longer, then whatever anybody else thinks, you can wave your flags as long as you like, the war's going to come to an end. Russian troops in 1917 voted with their feet. The third is the home front, because without the food, ammunitions and so on, if this is not produced, then even if the army are prepared to fight, even if the ruling class want to fight, no fight can continue. So if any of those three collapse, then you have a very, very serious situation from the point of view whatever country it happens to be. Indeed, wars continue until one or more of those three essential legs of the stool collapses. When they do, the war ends. And of course, when that occurs, the authority of whoever had been in charge tends to be undermined, tends to be affected. And so wars tend also to be very revolutionary things. The only problem you have here, trying to keep within my time limit, the only problem you have here is simply this, that people during the war, and I took part in, I was in the ILP and later became a fellow traveller of the Trotskyist movement and then into the Trotskyist movement, but we assumed that we should have a rerun of the First World War, that history will repeat itself. In fact, the powers that be know history too, and therefore take action to avoid it being repeated, or try to take that action to stop it being repeated. And you fight a war in order to secure peace. An interpenetration of opposites. You don't fight war because you like war. No, if the other side gives in, submits to then all well and good, that's it. So from 1942 onwards, America had an organization merely considering how it could bring the type of regime which it wanted, not what you and I would want, into Europe. So you could have the first wave charging up the beaches in Sicily, but the important thing was the third or the fourth wave, which didn't charge up the beaches, which included financiers and other advisers who liaised with their Sicilian counterparts. So you've nothing to fear from us. As long as you accept the idea of AMGOD, this is the military occupation, then we're wanting you to keep your positions. And the same, incidentally, will apply to the police. You might have tortured your people, you might have filled socialists with olive oil until their bladders burst. Well, that doesn't really matter. You're a good policeman, and you can still continue. And actually, the other thing which they did at the was they brought in the mafia. Mussolini had got rid of the mafia. They brought it back, you see. But what we didn't go into, or at least with the exception of F.A. Ridley, and perhaps one or two others, we didn't realise, and clearly it was important, so far as the powers that be, that the same ruling class remains there in Italy, remains there in Germany and so on. So, right, how can you do that? You can't do that by keeping a fascist party Mark II. You've got to have a change in image. You've got to have a change of costume, a political costume. And so what do you have? You have Myron Taylor, who was the personal ambassador for President Roosevelt, being sent to the Pope. And the Pope played a key part in this, as Ridley points out. And then you have, and I think this was a miracle, no, it was contrived, you have the creation of Christian democratic parties in Italy, Germany, France, Belgium, and so on. So what would have been, the people who were supporting the fascist party today, they're supporting the Christian Democrats tomorrow. And this was not really appreciated by many on the revolutionary left. They saw the betrayal of the Communist Party, the way in which the Communist Party went into, if you took it, the coalition government in Italy, led by a man who'd led the invasion of Abyssinia and the use of poison gas there, Badoglio. They saw the role which the Communist Party played in France. They didn't fully understand that it was important, A, for the state apparatus, to be moved from being a fascist state apparatus to being one which worked within a normal parliamentary democratic system, and B, that the parties take on a new image, namely that of being Christian Democrats rather than merely being Nazi or fascist. So these, I think, are some of the important points. I haven't really dealt with a lot of things I would like to, but I'm sure many people would like to raise matters, so I'll sit down and listen to you. Thanks.
Well, half an hour. Do you want to ask questions or make conclusions?
Yeah, I tend to disagree with you just on one point, but not a major point, but I think when you're analysing the fascist thing in the 1940s and the votes that were got for those candidates, the truth was all those candidates were backed by the Stalinists, and this was because they discredited themselves, because they had been cheerleading right up until the Molotov Ribbentrop Pact. And they knew very well they would get very, very far. They didn't get very, very far, and they built the candidates under their own name. So we got the mysterious appearance of workers and pensioners, anti-war candidates and things, which of course were just a shielding bullet for the Stalinists. But the interesting thing, of course, is that when the Stalinists swung around from being against the war before it started, being for the war before it started, and then against the Dachau it started, Of course, a lot of the feeling they were appealing to, especially with the People's Convention, was of course middle-class pacifism. And on the whole, one can say that the workers themselves at that time, whilst not being enthusiastic for war, were not so keen on a pacifist point of view. And I think that's because they actually believed what their rulers said, that they were backing Nazism and all the rest. And I think you'll find that if you look at it, the working class opposition to war grows towards the end in certain sectors. The millions of new workers who were having to join the workforce and join trade unions because of the expansion of the war effort, and of course the radicalisation of people in the army. And so I think you've got to be very, very careful when you talk about opposition to war and anti-war people. It actually has a different class character, it actually does change in the course of the war. And a lot of that is to do with people who were been excluded from trade unions and excluded from working class organisations for years, actually getting jobs for the first time. Remember, in 1940 there was still a million unemployed.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet in 1941, when Hitler's army dominated Europe, British imperialism in its production actually overtook that in Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
I think you've got to be very, very careful when you talk about anti-war and pacifist feeling. It actually changes its class character as the war goes on.
Come back at the end and not left.
Okay.
Can I ask three short questions? Any comments on the... shall we can stop?
Yeah.
Okay. Have you any comments on the Spanish Civil War? I remember one of these meetings I went and spoke to Michael Foote in that, and he said that if the Spanish Civil War had been handled differently, the Second World War might not have happened. I couldn't follow what he was talking about, but he did say that. The second one is, okay, there's a TV situation company called Hello, Hello, and they always have this woman who's represents herself as being the communist resistance. Was that actually, were there in fact two types of resistance, or was that sort of, The third thing is, was it amazing and miraculous that the Russians kept on fighting right to the end? And I've heard that view expressed, it was really quite surprising that they kept going in the face of, the Nazi onslaught.
Say
anything
else?
Yeah, you said there was a strike wave, was it in
1944?
Can you say a little bit more about that, how it was received and what actually happened?
Okay.
You were talking about people becoming more and more aware of the class character of the war and mentions the class character of society rather than things like the differences in air raid shelters and so on. You mentioned things like Scarborough and so on. Let's talk about air raid.
This was true in the United States also. The anti-war movement was a very mixed one at the beginning of the war. Partly, as I kind of underestimated in the case of the war too, there was a real difference in American movement. That's about which side they wanted to support. And there was, of course, there was also an enormous reservoir of pro-fascist sympathies in the United States. A lot of anti-British feeling, Irish and German, a tremendous amount of native anti-Semitism in the United States. And that did fuel a lot of the anti-war movement. There were sophisticated left-wing opponents of the war. And they had a certain following really up until the fall of France. At that point, it was really, it was quite a different thing. That is, there was a tremendous amount of pro-allied feeling at that point among progressive and left-wing circles and in the working class. And as a matter of fact, precisely the more left-wing sections of the CIO and labor movement that at that time were pro-Roosevelt and pro-war. The anti-war sentiment initially in the American labor movement were the business unions. Their attitude was war. That means labor shortage. That means we can do good business. And it's the more sophisticated people like the Luthers and the Hillians and so on, who, not simply for imperialist reasons, but put it another way, they were so frightened by Nazism that they were pro-imperialist for that reason as well. And it's only the really popular anti-war feeling doesn't begin to build until 1942 or 43, when it becomes the consequences of the strike pledge and accommodating the right on everything, including vicious racism, shipping Japanese Americans off to concentration camps and so on. It's only at that time that people begin to see through it. And it's also clear by 42 or 43 that the war is won. The Nazism has been defeated. People start saying, well, why are we still fighting? What's going on here? But I think you have to approach it from that point of view, because if we simply emphasize the original anti-war movement, it had a very complex character, and especially from September 39 to June 41, when the Communist Party, which was stronger in the United States even than I think in Britain, was using all the old anti-imperialist slogans in support of their side during the war, but you got a tremendous revulsion among the best trade unions. One little piece of history that's very important there is the American SWP, Canada used to give it out, is a series of discussions with Trotsky in 1940. When Trotsky suggested that it might be a good idea to ally with the Communist Party, propose some political alliance with them around anti-war candidates of the type that now is trying to take place here. And James Buchanan, the American Trotsky's leader, with strong roots in the American trade union movement, said basically, you're crazy, this will not work. That is to say, if you cannot with those old anti-war imperialist slogans in alliance with the Communist Party, which everybody knows at this point is pro-Nazi, basically, you will discredit everything yourself with the best people. He wasn't talking about accommodating simply the reference about the Communist Party. So I think you have to be very careful about that. Everybody's anti-imperialist when it's the other side and in terms of everybody attacking him. And I think I'm less familiar with the British thing, so I think that some of that, a lot of people in Britain were not so sure the Canadian alliance would get those might be better than alliance with the Roosevelt. It's a business deal certainly had nothing to do with propaganda about saving British allies or fighting fascism or anything like that.
I'll take one more speaker from Glenn and then bring that back.
My question is, recognising what imperialist interests were, what should, in hindsight, knowing what happened in relation to Nazism, what attitude should working class and revolutionaries have had towards the question of Nazi occupied Europe, what was happening under there, and what should workers have had when threatened by occupation by Nazi regime? What should anti-fascists and workers have had? I mean, notwithstanding the imperialist motivation.
Okay. Well, firstly, during the war there was a political truce. The Labour Party, Conservatives, and Liberals didn't fight one another. So you had a variety of candidates standing, some of them quite oddball. There was somebody who was the editor of a cheesecake magazine, nude women, and he stood at Scarborough, and he didn't get very many votes. He says, well, I only did it to have a holiday. That's the only reason why he stood. But what you did get was, first of all, the first by-election, which occurred, was in December 1939, when the the Manchester constituency of Stretford, the ILP put up a candidate and the Communist Party put up a candidate. And the interesting thing there was that the ILP got 4,474 votes as against the Communist Party, who got 1,519. Both of these, of course, were anti-war, and they were getting more votes than, as a proportion, than the Labour Party was getting in the 1935 general election. And then you have a whole series of candidates. I mean, the period in which I like to take, because I think this is a period in which there was popularity for the government was very, very low. 50% thought the government was doing badly and only about 25% doing well. This is 1942 when the Conservatives lost five solid Conservative seats. Incidentally, including Grantham, where there was a young lady called Hilda Margaret Roberts, who was just becoming interested in politics. And if she went along to the Conservative election meetings, she would see a member of the Communist Party on the platform talking about the glories of the Red Army and the importance of defeating this candidate who didn't believe that the government was behaving in a correct way. Now, a variety of candidates. The Commonwealth Party came into existence in this period, winning seats, incidentally, which, and on a left-wing basis, if you want to know what the Commonwealth Party was like, I would say roughly a wedgie bend policy today, under Richard Ackland. And it won Edisburgh, with a person who'd been a fighter pilot in the Spanish Civil War, John Loveston. It won Skipton, which a relative of mine succeeded, only in marriage, succeeded in losing at the landslide victory of 1945. Commonwealth could win it on a very much lefter basis than the Labour Party ever put forward. Five seats went. When W.J. Brown won Rugby, he protested to Attlee. He said, why didn't you send a letter supporting my opponent? It would have, you're so unpopular, it would have given me another 500 votes. That was his position. So there was a whole variety of candidates, but it is also true that there was growing up a feeling of discontent. You might say it was not clearly delineated, and it was confused. But there was this feeling of discontent. Orwell suggests that there was a revolutionary situation in 1942 and in 1944, and he expected 40 and 42, and he expected one also at the end of the war. Undoubtedly, a popular feeling against what the government was doing. Coming to the Spanish Civil War, on this, in this book, I have a chapter on the Spanish Civil War for a simple reason, that in Spain, and it's easy to get a victory in a war, if in the same way as I think it was Cervantes who said he could solve all the economic problems of Spain. So I can solve all the economic problems of Spain as long as people don't eat for 3 months. Right? Then there won't be any more problems. Right? And you could see that the war was going to be won by Franco because you were not stopping the fascists sending arms in, no arms were coming in, no raw materials from Britain and from the United States. And the reason for this was quite simple. Most of the investment in Spain, most of the plantations, most of Rio Tinto's zinc and the mines and so on, were British. So when the revolution came in 1936, it was British investments which were copying it. So they were very pleased to see Franco. They knew in advance that this was going to occur. Two British agents actually went. They took two girls with them. They left Croydon Airport, got into Havilland Rapide, went to pick Franco up, and then he started the revolt in the Canaries. That is what happened. And what one sees, actually, is that the Labour Party, right throughout, was supporting Franco. I mean, you know, 1937, he holds the Prime Minister's hand up at the Labour Party Edinburgh conference. But in fact, in 39, he's wanting to send him out of Britain because Franco doesn't want it. And also, during the war and after the war, there were Spanish prisoners in British detention. Indeed, I'm trying at the moment to get accounts of three of them who went through this experience and went there to 48, 49. So, Spanish Civil War. So far as Russian fighting is concerned, Russia fought on the basis, the old Tsarist basis, that it was a great, the great patriotic war. The way in which, but one of the reasons for which they won, and Fuller puts this forward in his book. Fuller said, "I spoke to a German officer who said I was there when Germany lost." So who was you at Stalingrad? She says, "No, I was at Kiev." "Well, what happened at Kiev?" He said, "We put the swastika up, we didn't put the flag of Ukrainian nationalism up. If we had tried to enlist the support of the various nationalities who had been the victims of Stalinist imperialism, then we would have won the war." Now, I think there's more to it than that, but nevertheless, I think this was an important point. They lost because of racism. Germans were, this is an under class, an under race, where we're not treating the Slavs as like us. They also lost because they, instead of, if I'm wanting to kill our comrade chairman, which I'm not wanting to do, I don't have to destroy every living cell in his body immediately. One shot in his brain will do it. This is what Little Hart said. What you should have done is to have attacked Moscow, which was the nerve centre of the Soviet Union. Instead of that, they were concerned about such things as getting control of the Ukraine because it had all the goodies there. They wanted to get Leningrad because of bloody Lenin, and then Stalingrad, and all this was stupid. You should have gone for the nerve centre, and that's what they didn't do. 1944 strike wave. Well, this was pretty colossal, you know. If you take the next 25 years, there are only seven which had as many strikes, well, days lost in strikes as 1944. And it applied to the coal mines, it applied to engineering, and it applied, incidentally, despite the fact that there were 696 regulations under which people could be arrested and imprisoned. And there were many people who were arrested and imprisoned. But despite that, the strikes went on, and often went on until you liberated the people who'd been put in. You weren't going back to work until they were allowed out. And this happened at in the Kent Colliery, it happened in Yorkshire, and so on. You might get the leaders of the union, Abe Moffat in Scotland, praising Colonel so-and-so, who's chairman of the Fife Iron and Coal Company and the Red Army, and calling for the lads to go back to work. But they were disregarded. And what was said was that Willie Gallagher, who was known as Red Willie, had become Red, White and Blue Willie. It was in his constituency that the pit, Blair Head, which had had 20 disputes, more than anywhere else, happened to be located. What else have we got? American anti-war movement, yes, but I would make the point to you that what happened was, and this is a bloody lie, you know, it will go down in infamy and history and all the rest of it, that the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. First of all, it is quite clear that the Americans had intercepted the communications relating to this. They knew the attack was going to occur. If, for example, you get Hong Kong Kai Tak Airport, the history of it, we were making preparations for the war 2 days ahead. I wrote a paper which says that the Americans were told that this was occurring, going to occur many days ahead. Incidentally, I don't know how you can move millions of troops to attack anywhere. It's like a massive number of people going on holiday in August without other people being aware that this is taking place. So the Americans were aware that that was taking place. And it wasn't then the Americans who declared war on Germany. No, they merely were fighting the Japanese. And it was Hitler, stupid bugger that he was, who declared, he thought, well, we're sure to win, and so we'll declare war on the United States. That's what happened. Incidentally, it's also important to say that the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs didn't end the Second World War. It would have ended anyway. And 3 months before the war ended, the Japanese were suing for peace. Anybody who's interested in that, I'll go into a lot of detail on that, and there was... this applies both to American sources and to British sources. It really needs to be written out. So far as the occupied countries are concerned, I don't know who really had the worst experience. What was said, and in this book I have a cartoon of the time, The Horrors of Buchenwald, and somebody's got the wrong photograph in. They've got an Indian photograph. Either 2 to 3 million were starved in India in 1942, not because it was a bad harvest, no, it was a good harvest that year, but because all the means of communicating, all the means of bringing the grain to the people, all the trains were being used by the military in the battles of Imphal and Kohima. So you say keeping the brightest jewel in the imperial crown is more important than the lives of the Indian masses. And this is one of the things which helped to change Indian opinion. And the following year, there was a massive opposition to British rule in India. And here in London, when the Communist Party was saying, let's have a second front, let's have a second front. There was an ILP who said the second front has already been opened, and it's been opened against British fascism in India by our comrades. And I don't know which is worse, what is done by Britain or was done by Germany. I'm not wanting to be a judge here, because I think that if I must stand up for my country, I will do that and say that our ruling class has been the worst, the most vicious in the world. I don't think anyone has been worse.
Another 15 or 20 minutes for discussion.
No.
The man at the back in the blue shirt.
People are quite strong, they hold to the war. It's kept before recently with remembrance staying alive. The kind of a media sense that the war had to be fought, and a lot of these people were completely kind of silenced and completely kind of disenfranchised, so to speak. The second thing is it not true that the British establishment grew hard from that scene? Yeah, it counts. It could have stopped these by bombing Ruby Land. It could have stopped slaughter by hitting the
Ruby
infrastructure. So a lot of this could have been stopped.
Yeah.
For some reason, it wasn't.
They actually suppressed any
Can we switch to the chair, please? Right, very nice. Have you finished?
Yeah.
Tim.
Congratulate speaking. I don't know, actually, I have so many pieces of information put together about the Second World War which changed your attitude about it. Myself, like a lot of people, thought for socialists, it was like everything was put on hold because the war came along, you know, the fascist threat, that everybody was able to be mobilised against it. And at the best that Trotsky's could do maybe was occasionally win a battle about where he stayed in a tube station or the other little battle here and there. I think it changed my attitude towards it completely. But where we're from in Nottingham, St. Trotsky's in an arms factory, Royal Ordnance factory, and apparently they managed to make some headway in organising and opposing the war. They went on strike and got big high wages in there. And I've always wondered how they managed to do it. You know, if you actually strike and say, well, refuse to send guns to the front. I think we're important guns as well, like machine guns that were required there. How they managed to actually get some of the workers in that period. So you partially answered it for me. But you think that if there was actually, there had been thousands of Trotskyists available with the conditions that they were, if you could have actually changed it, or do you think that the actual conditions would be too great again?
Yeah. I mean, I think your comments on the Holocaust are actually very, very unsatisfactory. You don't deal with the question of the Holocaust by saying, well, something else happened somewhere else which is comparable or not comparable. I think comparative genocide is not the way of dealing with things. And I think the point is, the question I was asking wasn't, it's partly whether there was, whether there might have been a correctness in terms of working classes making tactical alliances occasionally with the ruling class against a particular genocidal enemy. That's partly it. It's also the question of whether there was an independent position that the class could have taken in terms of saying that in terms of the threat of Nazism. And I know it's a question of hindsight. We know about the Holocaust then, now. People didn't know nearly as much then about what was actually going on. But it seems to me that the working class had a responsibility, and certainly would have had a responsibility if it knew the nature of what was going to happen, and if some of the information that had been suppressed was available to it. There would and could have been a question of a working class resistance against fascism and against the complete capitulation of the ruling classes of those countries since the invasion of the Nazi forces. And it seems to me that you're avoiding that question, that being anti-imperialist doesn't mean necessarily being abstentionist towards the Nazi regime, nor does it mean being abstentionist towards what the British are doing in India, for that matter. And I'm not saying you sort of trade off one against the other, quite the contrary. I think that sort of trading off of things is a very dangerous way of talking.
Yeah. I'm going to take the speaker in black, because everyone else who's had a hand up and spoke before.
One is to do with the welfare state. It's about the radicalisation that achieves many things to change. And I wonder if it can be explained to us. Is there something about wars that happened in the First World War? Is there something about the years of extended wars where people do really change about the way they deal with society? Because wars do come about as a result, as you quite rightly observed, of economic crisis. And perhaps there's something in the fighting that people realize, well, we want a different situation. Before the Second World War started, was severely criticized by revolutionaries, actually, as being totally inadequate in the terms of collapse. But it's what we got. It's what we got, I suppose, to make sure that it wasn't something not fighting for capitalists, you know. It also looks as though they needed a very healthy workforce within their own industries, a very healthy and well-educated workforce, but I just think a lot of it was that people had aspirations and had to deal with it. So perhaps it was very common on radicalisation. A little bit was about the Holocaust and other things related to that, actually, not just that role again of revolutionaries in well, there's only sort of one very tiny, narrow, politically narrow, step of group, to set people in the whole world. But actually, given any explanation at all of how fascism arises and how you can actually stop it before it gets to a certain point, it's just looking at it. That, those voices weren't listened to. You then got to say, what do you do now? Because you've got Bangalore, you've got it today, you've got Muslim here. What do you do now? Again, it's only there are disagreements and technical differences, but again, it's basically sort of one group of people asking things of the same. We can still do this, we can still do things we can do. It's about broadcast resistance. And even at the end of the war, right to the end, some people had a policy of in the death camps, they were putting forward proposals in the death camps for unity of workers and press people and what we should be saying to the people who were in the machine gun towers and what we're going to say to the troops in Crimea. Like that. And again, it's the same political group of people. And they had actually a policy for taking that war. You know, the end of the war wasn't the end of the war. The only way you beat fascism is not by we've got the military solution, got nice so good by capitalism, but the possibility of revolution in advanced countries. Because then the role of the Communist Party was to go and smash that up. But again, it was, you know, the revolution circles why the policy don't it. And why that's in practical suggestions that how we need to do it.
I'm going to take this last four speakers.
Question, what about the Labour Party? With an electoral machine not fighting the elections, what was going on with it? Also in 1944, the left-wing conference and so forth, politics parties. What was going on there? And I understand there was a number of, with the Labour role in the coalition government, I mean, there was a lot of domestic policy, what was going on with the Labour term as well. But there some occasions where there were disputes in Parliament over domestic policy. The only thing you mentioned before about the party, you know, it's a group of people in the Rochdale Labour Party now, it used to be in that group of the Communist Party of Wales. Can you fill in a little bit about how that fitted together and also, you know, you say you're in the ILP or something? You know,
On the Holocaust business, one of the things that was a book written in the mid-70s called 6 Million Die. There were a couple other books written about the same time, created a tremendous furor, and then they were dropped. Because what they indicated, what they detailed, was the way in which, in order to fight the war, the British and the Americans both suppressed all knowledge of the Holocaust. That is, not only were they not fighting to stop it, not only did they refuse the pleas that were coming out of Europe that detailed exactly what was going on there, they actually said, no, we can't do it. And it says something about what the so-called anti-fascist war meant at home, especially in the United States, where there's no question about it being a capitulation to native anti-Semitism. And so that's the kind of war they were fighting. It seems to me that you need a whole other talk about something else, namely what could have been done and what should have been done, and, for example, what the real defects of the left-wing peace movement and the libertarian movement was.
To be honest, on the Holocaust, when the news first came out, I believe it was pretty obvious about the news. Because during the First World War, the British had spread such appalling anti-German propaganda, the Germans brought Belgian children and called them unbearables. And of course, it was very quickly found out in 1918 that was a pack of lies. And when some of these stories came out, people didn't believe it because they didn't like it before that. And I mean, that is very, very simple. You can actually analyse as it comes to the news. But I think with regard to disrupting the movements to the gas, it was proved umpteen times in that war and since. In fact, if you bomb railway lines, they can be put together in a matter of bloody hours afterwards. You cannot take out communication systems by any railway lines. It's the simplest thing in the world. As the Vietnamese proved in that when it was far more blast power dropped on North Vietnam during the course of the war, so I think the idea that they would have stopped it by that is nonsense. But to turn to other things, about the Nottingham Arms Factory business, I've written about it in that book of Sam Bornstein, if you want to read that part about it. Unfortunately, because Militant didn't let me interview Claude Bartholomew before he died, it couldn't be up the whole picture, unfortunately. and ask the city and they will give you the address. And with regard to the Trotskyist intervention in the war, and this is where I must admit I was disappointed by Ray's article, not the book, I haven't read yet, because I'll read it with great interest when I can. I don't think it points out, and that should be pointed out, because the Stalinists have tried to get all the credit for this. They've had the first political decision to leave people, to smash open the field gates, was taken by the Workers' International League. And I've not only seen the decision written out in Miller's own handwriting in the minute books period at the time, but I've also seen correspondence from other referees that agrees that that was the case. In fact, the Stalinists did not initiate that at all. At the time, they were taking around the petition to get addressed to the right on the Winston Churchill landscape. It was, in fact, the will of Trotsky, except, of course, the Stalinists had died out on the fence. So, in fact, that's an interesting thing, and that is a hidden piece of the real working class attitude of the war that's been totally and deliberately removed from the record of the health.
I'd still like to know your views on French resistance and how much it was polarised between some so-called communists. I'd also like to know your views on the British intervention in Greece, which is another one of these funny stories. And there's another sidelight on social history, which is, according to Alex Comfort, prostitution was made a reserved occupation during the Second World War. I wonder how this worked. I didn't know that. I wonder if there's any sort of class implication or subtext there. Anyway.
Last speaker then.
Personally, I think like the Second World War is somewhat unique in that it's the only war that the working class actually had an interest in making sure one side would be beaten, because it was in the interest of the working class that fascists were beaten. If fascists hadn't been beaten, that would have been a terrible blow for the working class worldwide, it would have been a terrible blow for the working class everywhere. So we would draw that distinction between, say, the Second World War and all other wars. But just a couple of points on the hidden history. I mean, for instance, in a very good book by, I think, Brian Hyland, he points out that throughout the Second World War, British and American and Canadian, other capitalist classes, big companies, were actually trading with Germany, Japan, supplying them with arms, equipment. And for instance, like a quarter of all German tanks in the Second World War were supplied with oil that come from Standard Oil, which was an American company, you know, and they made sure that their supply got through no matter what, you know. So actually, these ships that supposedly supplying Britain with lend leaks actually going to Germany first to make sure they got the oil, otherwise their tanks would find the American troops on the beaches, you know. And this went throughout the war, and like there was the international banking settlements in, I think it was Bubble, not Geneva. And there was millions and billions of dollars going through there. And if that fact had sort of been known, you know, how could Trotskyists and revolutionaries have used facts like that, you know, to call for the taking over a society? The second point in Italy, immediately after the end of the Second World War, during the Second World War, the World War Fight was still going on. The CIA, or the precursor of the CIA, MI6, actually set up the post-war Italian government with large sections of the Italian Fascist Party as senior ministers. There was a standby, a Gladio army set up by them, consisting mainly of the fascist military units, not the ordinary soldier units, but the particular military units to ensure that post-war Italy would have the kind of government and the system that they wanted, and that they relied on the fascists to ensure that.
Well, just to reply on the last point, in January 1946, the Italian writer Ignazio Silone came to this country because 60,000 members of the Italian resistance had had their homes blown up by fascists in league with the police. There had been, on the one hand, the Communist Party disarming the resistance. There had been, on the other hand, the Allied forces at Anvert keeping the fascist strong-armed men still in their position. It's also interesting, but whatever the position apropos bombing communication to the death camps, the interesting thing is that the death camps were designed by 25 scientists from IG Farben. These were prosecuted at the end of the war as war criminals. At the end of the trial, the judge gave them what the amount of fine that you get for sheep stealing. And the American who had done the prosecution went away in rage and wrote a book which was published 4 years later on these merchants of death. Incidentally, it's important to say that it was a Labour government in this country who was involved in this. It wasn't merely a Conservative government which was involved in this. On the question of political interest and so on, well, obviously groups like yours are very important, and you do as much as you possibly can. But circumstances change. According to Morris Isserman on the Workers' Party of the United States, the Schachmanites, they had, I think it was 235 members, and they got out, week by week, Labour Action, 40,000 copies. That's only because they were probably not all of them were sold, but nevertheless, there was quite clearly an interest which does not apply at the present time. If you take the RCP in this country, 350, 400 would you say? 1944? Yeah, 450. 16,000 copies of Socialist Appeal. It's not because they're supermen and superwomen. It is the fact that there were very, very many more people, not talking about Wimbledon, but talking about politics. And what puts you in this position? I'm air raid watching, a warden, right? And you happen to be a warden. And we chat about things. We've got hours and hours to chat about it. And there are many situations which are similar to this. And therefore, it's not merely the number of papers and the number of books which are got out, but also the way in which they're passed from hand to hand and discussed in a way which doesn't apply today. Now, on the question of the war, and our friend over here said, well, why did you have Beveridge and full employment and so on? Suppose I come from Jarrow. There's been the hunger march from Jarrow in 1936, and you expect me to be in the first wave on June the 6th, 1944, invasion, where I think only half of them were killed and injured in the first hour. And you say, now look, Challoner, if you're lucky you won't be injured, you'll be able to go back to the dole queue in Jarrow. No, if you're going to say that to me, am I going to fight? You've got to promise more. Things are going to be better after the war. And this was, otherwise morale is going to collapse. And when Churchill and Ernest Bevin went down to Portsmouth to see the first wave off, they were told, we'll be going back to the dole queues after the war, and Bevin and Churchill promised them that this would not occur. And of course it's important to make these points, that by comparison with people today, people like, in one sense, Ernest Bevin and actually the raving revolutionaries. Who today is talking about a welfare state with security from the cradle to the grave? Who is talking about full employment? Who's talking about a free National Health Service? What would happen to a lot of people if they were to put these ideas forward? It is the fact that then, and I would sort of take James Connolly here, James Connolly says, well, you have working people in a position where they're liable to take over the bakery, you then give them the crumbs. They had really no alternative at that time but to make the concessions which they did. So far as the Labour Party was concerned, it was extremely interesting. I'm not sure, I think it was £13 worth of literature was sold by the Labour Party in 1940. 43. Labour Party as an organisation virtually ceased to exist. And it's not me who says this, but you can find quite important people in the Labour Party to say this, who said this. And why? For a very simple reason. If you have meetings by address by Attlee or Bevan, then they're shouted down. They'd be hell let loose. They don't want to meet their membership. So what happens if you have to have a meeting? It will be somebody from the Ministry of Information who will come along. Somebody who's not a Labour Party member. You'd be polite to him. Actually, the person from the Ministry of Information would be an intelligence agent who would be sent along. And the problem which the Labour Party faced was, how do you fight an election? First of all, 1918, bloody hell, there was the Carkey election, and anybody who attacked Lloyd George was very, very badly defeated. Will the same occur again? Secondly, all the measures which have been put forward by the coalition government, you have agreed to, as well as the Conservatives. So how can you then attack those? So there are many, many people in the Labour Party who are in favour of continuing the coalition after the war. And this is one of the reasons why so many socialists were prepared to support a variety of independent left-wing candidates. And it was Richard Atland who wrote a book called Unser Kampf, who played an important role in doing this. He was the founder of Commonwealth. He was also actually the founder of CND in a later period. A person who, as it were, saw that there was within British society, meaning between the working class and the lower middle class, a very considerable kinship which they hadn't realised before the war. And if you take the very conservative area of Chelmsford, in 1945, Wing Commander Millington for the Commonwealth won the seat from the Tories, and his slogan was "Hands off the Greek Revolution." This was the line which was adopted entirely more revolutionary line than anybody would adopt today. But the Labour leaders, of course, went along with the repression of General Scobie and co, and incidentally used to murder left-wing girls a man called Grivas, who became head of AOKA and fought the British in Cyprus years later. One further thing probably worth mentioning, and that is that just in the same way, coming back to the question of death camps and the way in which I.G. Farben and Crooks got their capital back after the war, in Japan there was Camp 731. This was where you tortured and tried experiments on dissidents and politicals. And at the end of the war, far from being concerned about the question of war crimes, these people were brought and taken to the United States. They will be invaluable in our chemical and biological warfare section. It is what Tom Bauer called the paperclip conspiracy. You sought out the people with key knowledge. Don't think that it was a love for, I would say, Palachi, the head of the Stasi in Croatia, who used to keep a container like this full of eyeballs of Tito's partisans and Serbs. No, he was taken by the British and put in Innsbruck. And Tito knew the house in Innsbruck, the street and the house in Innsbruck where he was. But it could well be, if war came, 1946-47, between Britain and America on the one hand and Russia on the other, this man Pavlovich would be useful to us. And so we want the Pavloviches of these world. They know how to do things. So don't think you're fighting for freedom or liberation or even anti-fascism. If you fight along with the British government, what you find yourself supporting is some of the biggest human monsters that there are.
Anyone wants to continue this conversation with Ray just after the meeting? I think it's about 10 or 15 minute break, and the next session is the main hall. It's a plenary session with the way forward.
£5
If you want. Right, so just the one copy?
You should get your printers to probably slap it down the spine.
I'm sorry, if you have this perfectly true, and in other editions,